Coming to you direct from the nerve center of the galaxy's greatest comic. This is the 2000 AD Thrillcast.
Borag Thung, Efflitz, and welcome to the latest episode of the On Time 2000 AD Thrillcast. I am your erstwhile host, Molchar. And on this episode, we've got three guests over two chats. The first is going to be with Stitch, who is a writer who writes as Xena Hutton. They have a novella out in a week's time, which is part of the Judges series of novellas, which are set in the very early days of Judge Dredd's world. So the Judges have been established, but they've not yet become Justice Department as we know them now. Infamous, which is available, will be available as an ebook and limited print edition from 2080.com, as well as for Kindle devices, is out next week. And a great opportunity to connect with Stitch and just discuss some of the themes of the novella, what it's like being an American writer at the moment in the year of Grud 2021. Infamous charts two characters, Judge Kira Clayton, who's young and idealistic and bored, and also Amara Dawson, whose bid for internet fame isn't paying off until she attracts the attention of a gang of viral pranksters. It riffs on, you know, what would you do to be famous in a dystopia like the beginnings of Judge Dredd's world? So kind of stretching back to the comment that the series made way back in the 70s and 80s about the nature of fame and the price of fame, but bringing it bang up to date and, you know, with everything else going on, it's really interesting. The second chat is with Oliver Pickles and David Roach, who have both been on the podcast before, and we're going to be chatting about the Judge Dredd by Brian Bolland Apex Edition. The pre-order recently ended for that, so I thought it'd be a nice time to just sit down and discuss what's in store for those of you who ordered it. And by Grud, it's going to be a cracker, tracking down over 140 pages of original artwork for this huge, oversized book. I mean, I've seen the PDFs and they're just stunning. So the finished article is going to look amazing. So it was great to connect on that and also talk about upcoming projects for the Apex line. So without much further ado, as always, let's crack on and chat to Stitch about Judges Infamous. Okay, so it's wonderful to welcome Stitch, writing as Xena Hutton, onto the Thrillcast. Welcome, Stitch.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's an absolute pleasure. Now, your next novella for us as part of the Judges series is out in a week's time. Do you want to tell us a little bit about Infamous? There's brackets in there as well, isn't there?
Yeah, very dramatic. I owe it to my past writing fan fiction. You know, you grab kind of the most dramatic title you can, and I couldn't use a Fall Out Boy lyric, so I went with the brackets. Infamous is about kind of like a recent high school graduate named Amara. She just really wants to be famous, and I was thinking of what it meant to be like a teenager a while ago, and what it meant for me pre-modern internet. Like, I wanted to be famous and all I had was MySpace, and I was not going to be MySpace famous. But what does it mean like in this kind of near alternate future where, you know, it's very high tech, very in your face internet? How do you become famous, you know? And if you're also impatient, the lengths you will go to become famous and how quickly that'll go really badly, because we've seen just in our ongoing world that teenagers and young adults will do kind of horrifying things to become famous, and they don't usually regret it until it is actually too late for them. And I was just like, I'm extremely online. And I was like, okay, but what if somebody was more online than me? And that's how I got Amara. And the group of people that she kind of links up with are kind of mimicking or like kind of calling back to established like TikTok users that I've seen or YouTubers, and just kind of how the culture of online fandoms and online communities can lead to a weird kind of groupthink where, especially in like collectives, you know, like a hype house kind of situation, people go really far in the attempt to then get really far fame wise. Yes.
Well, it's a really interesting concept because Judge Dredd has commented on the nature of fame and the ephemeral nature of fame since very early on. So obviously you get characters like Otto Sump, who you know is the archetype. Well, Sump Story, which was the show he went on to become famous, to become Otto Sump. So it's interesting that you kind of plug into that, but looking at it from the point of view right now, because of course when John Wagner and Alan Grant were writing Otto Sump, the internet didn't exist. So the concept of fame was very much a kind of old media TV kind of thing. It's interesting to me that you're exploring this because the internet doesn't really figure all that much in Judge Dredd's world. It's obviously evolved as the strip has been published, but do you think particularly when dealing with a near future situation like the judge's novellas are set in, that is there a risk of dealing with very kind of zeitgeisty stuff when talking about near future and a strip that's kind of embedded in the visions of the future of the past, if you see what I mean?
So I always because this is my second kind of foray into the world of Judge Dredd, because I did Flytrap, my Judge Anderson novella, 2019, early 2020, Time is Fake, don't remember. And I had to think like references that I wanted to make, or like a progression, like a line of references or progression of tech. I had to think like, will this make sense because of what the comics are doing? Because like, it's you looking backwards and forwards at the same time with Judge Dredd in many ways. And so I literally went into this going, I know that because I did my research, I was like, I know that internet specifically as we use it isn't a thing kind of in like a noted thing in the series in Judge Dredd, because as you said, like there was no way to like kind of imagine where we would be. But since Judge Dredd, that universe is this high-tech dystopia, the internet really fits in because we are in a high-tech dystopia ourselves. And so I was like, some things had to be like blurred or like fudged so that I could kind of allow myself to get away with it. Like the feature point of this is ViewTube, I think. I was like, this is probably going to be archaic the second it's published, but I was like, at least it's not a TikTok clone, because that would age negatively instantly. Like I would have typed the word like my alt for TikTok and instantly it would have been developed somewhere.
It's like all the occasional stuff I read now that from a few years ago that mentions vines. Yeah, and you go,
yeah.
Oh man, really? Oh dear. All right. No, I mean that's interesting because it's. I've always thought of Dredd and Dredd's world as one that's haunted by the past, and you see that in stories like The Cursed Earth and you know, things like that. And so it, for me, it always makes sense that Dredd's world isn't a parallel for ours in that respect, but it is haunted by our world, by aspects of our world. So really, you can just pick and choose the aspects of your world that you want to prefigure, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I love it.
Well, I mean, I'm interested to find out what your experience of writing Flytrap was like, that going straight into, because was this a world that you knew before you'd been commissioned?
I was a little casual, like a little filthy casual when it came to Judge Dredd. But I knew who the characters were, and I had a basic understanding of the dystopia setting, of even critiques of the world, because I follow a lot of comics fans and journalists, and like I did college work on like gender in comics. So I was like, oh, okay. So like, when David reached out, I was like, oh, you say Judge Anderson. Interesting. And I was very excited. So both times that I've been commissioned, I wanted to do a story about cannibalism, and that did not happen. Because I would get my little plot down, then I would think about like kind of like stuff I was seeing either like on the news or like just kind of in the real world. And with Flytrap, I was thinking about mythology. The characters are, because Cassandra is Cassandra, you know, the mythological figure who's never believed until it's too late. And I was thinking about other, just kind of like casually thinking about like other figures from that, like from the Trojan, what is that called? I can't remember the actual name for it, which is like really bad, but that arc in mythology. And I was thinking of Clytemnestra and the betrayal of fathers. And that's really kind of what started driving me, like thinking of like, what does it mean when someone who's supposed to take care of you just doesn't, and they hurt you? And like, I wanted to stay away. I did not want to do anything that would be kind of triggering beyond the mentions of like what's clear emotional and like psychological abuse. I didn't want those girls to be traumatized in any other way. But I was thinking like about, and this is wild because I have like a great relationship with my dad. He's adorable, but not everyone does, you know, and that betrayal of a parent or a parental figure who's decided that you are not good enough or that you have to behave a certain way. Like, it's something I wanted and hoped would be like kind of cathartic for people to read. And even up until the last couple of chapters when I was like writing, I was like, okay, but maybe I can get some cannibalism in here because I really hate this guy. You know, like I was writing, I don't remember the dad's name in Flytrap, but I hated him. So I'm writing and I'm like, if I could fight a character, it would be this guy, because it was just, he has two really brilliant children, two brilliant daughters who are absolutely powerful, and the only way he can think to capitalize off of that is in a way that hurts them. Yeah. So I had a lot of thoughts about that book as I was writing it. Lots of shouting. My mom had to like, what are you doing? Are you fighting someone on the internet? And I was like, no, I'm not even on the internet. I'm using a typewriter. Well, a word processor. I have an offline word processor. And I was like, no, I'm just writing. I'm just mad because I made this guy, and he was a good bad guy for me. It's like, ooh, I just want to fight him.
Does that happen so often? The shouting at somebody on the internet that it's kind of like a default.
Yeah, unfortunately, or wanting to shout, because I don't do it on the internet. So if I feel like shouting, I just shout out loud.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, because the other thing I do when I'm not writing fiction is I am a kind of a journalist, which is a lot, but pop culture fandom journalist. And if you've seen the increasingly negative responses to criticism across the internet, people really don't like criticism. And I talk a lot about like race and racism from like everybody talks about like the male fans who ran Kelly Marie Tran off of the internet after The Last Jedi came out. Nobody talks about how there's actually a female contingent of fans who like harasses people too. And they're not doing it because they think that there should be no diversity in Star Wars. They're doing it because they want their specific like fictional characters to kiss. And I'm like, that's even worse. Cause like, you're not even a cohesive racist. You're just an accidental one. And so they really don't like me. They've tried to get me fired from Teen Vogue twice this year. And that's a whole thing. And so I don't yell at them because even if I mentioned that I've been harassed while interviewing Kelly Marie Tran, and that was the second time they tried to get me fired. They were like, oh, she mentioned that people are harassing her. She's talking about us. And I was like, yes, I was. So me talking on my own is treated as me shouting. So I can't shout at them. So I just shout really loudly in my room.
I mean, this is a safe place to do it. I should imagine. I don't need to imagine. I've done it myself. I want to talk about the Judges book, Infamous, because there's quite a few subjects here that I want to touch on. The first is that you've got Judge Keira Clayton,
yes,
who's a young judge. The system is still new, has been explored by Michael Carroll and various other writers. You know, this is a system that is still finding itself and leading up to the eventual coup. But what struck me was it was a mention in the blurb that she's young, idealistic, and bored. And I'd like that notion, you know, that these kind of hyper specialist cops with all these powers and you know, in a dangerous situation, that one of them might be bored and is just passing the time by watching videos. Yeah,
I love Judge Clayton. I adore her because I was thinking, because it's like, everything's really complicated dealing with like law enforcement and literature because of, well, what law enforcement, not in literature, keeps doing. But I did grow up in a family with a lot of law enforcement. That's a thing. And so I know that a lot of them were bored and they would just, you know, screw around, like, hopefully not in ways that harmed people, but like if they were bored, they would, you know, walk with books to read, because this was like largely pre-modern internet. And I was like, how do you level that up to now, or that now for judges? And I got watches videos on their phone. Literally, I like envisioned her at points, like just kind of like crouching in a hallway or stairwell, just like on her phone, looking at the screen. And I'm like, simultaneously good at her job and bad at her job. And it makes sense because she's like really not that old. She's like early 20s, probably, because she's not that much older than Amara, the main character. But she's old enough that she's like, oh, that's a little baby, about Amara, in both like a condescending way, but also like, I have a niece, she's in her 20s, and she looks at her teenage sisters like, oh, these are infants. And I'm like, you're an infant. And so I was trying to like capture just that experience of being kind of like a little adult. Like you're not really, she's not really an adult. She is on her way to adulting, but she has this position where she has a lot of power. And I think that if I didn't make her bored and give her that outlet of the phone, she could have gone a completely different way. That would have probably been not great. Because like, as it is, she's kind of rude. She's kind of snarky. Like, she doesn't even care that her direct supervisor is like clearly fed up with her, you know. And I just I don't know, I just love her. I'm sorry, I just really love her.
With a character like that, where's your starting point? What, you know, where does that character spring from? Do you start thinking, well, this is the rough idea of what I want this book to do, or do you start with the character and build the idea out from there?
So I wanted to show, because I kind of built her out opposite Amara, because Amara is like, I want to create and be consumed like as a cultural product, and Clayton's like, I want to consume the cultural content. And so they're not necessarily foils of each other, but like they're kind of like, if not for the crime element, they would be like ships passing in the night. And so I think the first image I had in my head of Clayton was her on her phone, you know, like just finding somewhere kind of abandoned or like not as heavily trafficked to just sit and be on her phone. And she's doing it knowing like, yes, I have stuff to do, but what if I just go on my phone? And like, same with Amara. I started with the messaging on her computer, or like the idea of like using of failing at YouTube or ViewTube. I started with that image of just like a frustrated teenager going, okay, well, I've done so much work, why isn't it paying off? Because like I feel it still, you know, like I sit there and I'm like, oh, I've done all of this, why isn't life happening faster for me? And so, and I'm like 30, so I can't imagine like a 19, 18 year old kind of going, okay, well, where's my instant fame? Where's my money? Where are my subscribers? You know, like if I don't have patience, Amara sure as hell couldn't. So yeah. And the other characters, because there are just kind of like a wide cast of like just like peppered in, I was thinking of people that like kind of archetypal characters that you see in like different like just background characters that get to be like little itty bitty archetypes. Like you have the beauty queen. I do not remember her name because it has been a while, and I also put a lot of characters into that book. But the girlfriend, there's the character who is like the main gang leader's girlfriend. She's like the beauty queen archetype. Like I was thinking, like, what do you expect from a group of like terrible teenagers and young adults, like kind of like mall rats, right? And when I used to be a mall rat, there were you wouldn't expect the people that showed up. Like some of them looked goth, but others were like, oh, okay, so you're actually the homecoming queen. You just like to tip over mannequins at the store for fun. Okay, cool. Let's do it. You know, and so I was thinking about that. And like, I also, genuine emotion time. When I was a mall rat, I ran with a not great crowd, and I kind of steeped Infamous and the characters in that, because I was like Amara. I wanted specific things, and the people that were willing to provide those specific things were slightly older adults. And if you're 18 or 19, you don't necessarily think, why do these 23, 24 year olds want to be friends with me? You're just really happy to be included. And in Amara's case, she got out, hopefully without a record. I don't have a record, but like, thank God. But like, in my case, my too late happened and it wasn't great. So I was like, I would like Amara to have slightly better experience. And in her case, the complete douches that she ran with, they see a consequence. Also, they killed someone. That did not happen for me, thank God. Yes, sorry, genuine emotion over.
Well, I mean, that's interesting, because it there's so many things that that are happening in the world right now that find a parallel, that have an echo in the satire that is within Judge Dredd's world. And it has been noted by me and by others, actually just how close this near future, the near future of judges is. Is there a difficulty there when writing about this stuff that it can be too close sometimes, particularly if you know you are drawing from your own experience?
Yeah, so it's a choice I've always made. Like I don't pull like directly like people, like I'm not going to name someone after like a family member and be like, this is my cop. This is, you know, like I'm not going to have a cop named like Jenny, you know, cause like I had a cop cousin named Jenny. Like I'm not going to do that. So I don't want to get like that close, but like the concepts and themes are either close to my heart or like my mom watches the news pretty much all the time. So I'm literally hearing just like the worst that the world has to offer kind of on a regular basis. And I always think like when I'm working on something like this, but especially this, that we kind of have to, well, we can't avoid the ways that our world parallels like dystopias again, because kind of if you like took like a write-up of everything happening in the past 4 years back to like 1945 sci-fi communities. And you're like, hey, read this. Like after they finish panicking about how you did that, they would be like, what the hell are y'all living through? Because this is very dystopian. You know, you have the Boston Dynamics robot soldier dogs dancing with BTS one day and tackling protesters another day, you know, not the same dogs, hopefully. And so as I wrote Infamous, I was thinking like, how do I kind of keep the energy and keep some level of distance? And it's hard because, you know, even though law enforcement right now is like really bad, and it has been, like it always feels kind of sad to just write them off. So like I struggle with that. I know a lot of like urban fantasy writers struggle with like, how do you write law enforcement after everything law enforcement has done in the past like 5 years alone? And so I think that was the hardest part, kind of like trying to figure out a future of law enforcement that we kind of already know because it's in universe, you know, what judges become. So how do you write both keeping that in your mind, but also like what our sort of parallel present is like? And so that also inspired shouting in my room at night, lots of it. Lots of it.
I mean, from that point of view, sorry, that's my phone buzzing away. With Judge Dredd and also Judge Anderson, the dystopia, the awfulness of Justice Department's regime is leavened with, in Dredd's case, that kind of hardcore personal code. You know, like he applies the law equally to everybody. Well, it's still not great, but at least he's not a dick about it. And with Anderson, you know, she questions the system all the time and walks that tightrope. But when you remove both of them, when you remove that leavening, does that make it actually quite difficult to interact with this system, which, as you say, you know what it's going to become, you know the foundations that it's working from, and the parallels that it has with now. Is that difficult to write?
Yeah, it's a little difficult, especially when you're writing characters. So, like with Kira, with Judge Clayton, thinking, okay, so in your 20s, you're like this. Who are you going to be like 30 years from now? You know, like, even if you like, I would love to revisit her, but like, at what point will I get to revisit her? And what world would I write her into? You know, like, even as I'm writing her in her 20s, I'm like, okay, but what about when she's 40? You know, like, is she going to be the same? Like, will the world allow her to screw around on her phone? Will she want to? You know, would the Kiera Clayton 20 years from now in the 2070s be someone who helps a teenager who got in with the wrong crowd, you know? And so it's kind of like intrusive thought, literary style, because I had no need to sit there and think that through, but I did. And I was sitting there like, oh, but I now have to forget everything I theorized about her because I'm writing about her in her 20s. There are other like characters in the Justice Department that get dropped in, like her direct supervisor, Reyes, I think. And then like you have the tech department kind of sprinkled through, and then at the end. And it's clear that they are all part of the system. For better or for worse, they are clearly part of the system of justice and judgment. And writing within the system, writing those just like background characters or Reyes coming in to like scold Clayton, it was easier than I thought because I was just going, these are not main characters. But if I had to write something that was focused on the specific department, like, you know, like if I had to do Reyes on his own narrative, I think that would be incredibly difficult from the start. Like, it wouldn't be me going, oh, well, who will he be in 20 years? Because he's already like that. Like, I pictured him as a character who was already solidly enmeshed with the system. Like, yes, he has at the end, kind of like, yes, Judge Clayton kind of got through to him just in terms of like, we need new ways of thinking this through, but he's still working for the system. Like, it's not like, oh, well, maybe we should be kinder, gentler judges. It's, oh, maybe sometimes teenagers aren't useless.
Yeah. And that's one of the things that is being struggled with an awful lot is the notion of, can systems be reformed? Or are they, by their very nature, always on a path to become the most extreme version of themselves? As an American, and at this point in history, how does it feel writing about something like the judges? You've already touched on writing law enforcement, knowing people who are or have been in law enforcement, and then the very quick narrowing of the gap between our world and the beginnings of Judge Dredd's world, if only in the space of time. How does it make you feel is basically what I'm asking.
I think at points I was like, oh, this is so plausible. I think the ending, the kind of ending epilogue, I guess, that David helped me with, because I was like, this is hard. That was kind of the biggest, like when that was finished, I sat there and I was like, ooh, this is plausible. This is unfortunately, this feels like a vibe, but a bad vibe, because it's very much like everybody, unfortunately, is seeing what the United States is and the United States government is doing right now, right in front of our salads. It's bad, and it's been bad, but this is kind of the clearest it's been to people outside of the United States what is going on here and how fascism is really not something that has just taken root, but that has always been growing, and now it's like blooming, you know. And so writing kind of a precursor to writing within a precursor to this, you know, super sci-fi, super fash, America version of America feels really weird. It feels like you're driving towards something. And I'm like, oh, is this what like I'm no George Orwell, but I'm like, is this what like George Orwell felt like? And I was like, ooh, that's too much. I'm not there yet. It just felt kind of like Cassandra. Yeah.
Yeah, I find the Judge's novellas fascinating because to a certain extent, the whole thing has to be played with such a straight bat. You know, you can't... there's less room for maneuver in terms of introducing new elements because, as you say, we know where this story is going to go. And so the parallels, the satire is... just a lot more on the surface. And I'm interested as to whether you as a writer can find that help or a hindrance. You know, you're dealing with characters who are experiencing things from their own perspective, not necessarily proceeding within an understanding of history that's gone or history that's to come. And I think you've already kind of touched on this, whether you have to jettison all of that because you're writing these characters, you know?
Yeah. So I don't think out of the characters, so out of Amara and out of Judge Clayton, I don't think that they're very history savvy. Like I don't. Amara is extremely online, but I think her understanding, as I was writing her, her understanding of history is probably just in like tech or pop culture. And Clayton is kind of largely like head empty. Like she has stuff to, she's a job, but she's also like, I'm going to watch videos all day. Right. Like, so they're not people who are kind of anxiously refreshing their social media feeds for news. They're not doom scrolling. They're not reading books. They're not consuming politics. Right. So writing them and kind of not referencing like I didn't want to make them make any references to history or pop culture, not pop culture, to politics. That's why there are kind of like news articles kind of interspersed in between some of the chapters, because that information couldn't come from them. Because that's not their perception of the world. They're not people who are seeing like the response. Like Clayton is clearly going to have to deal, you know, in the distant future or not so distant future, with the coup and with what the future of the country will be like. But she's going to have to deal with it as a judge, which I feel is different from dealing with it as like how Amara will be kind of like as. Just like, I'm actually not sure what Amara will be, you know, in terms of like, she's been burnt, where will she go next? But she's definitely maybe not pro-judge. So she might in the future be a character that eyes the world kind of narrowly, kind of politically, but I couldn't write that into the book now because at this point she's still kind of like, ooh, I would like to be famous. And then, kind of almost instantly, no, I wouldn't. These people are really bad. And, ugh. You know, so she still hasn't kind of grown up, right, to think things through and to view the world wider and how, like, a thing that is normal to her is not normal to other people. Like, judges maybe shouldn't be normal to you. I don't know. Or the judge's tactics or something. And I don't know. I just think that it's really cool to kind of set that up. So you have these characters who are just like, yeah, I don't know what the fuck's going on. Ooh, can I curse? Ooh, sorry for cursing.
No. It's absolutely fine. It's absolutely fine.
Yeah, like that's kind of like how I went into it with them, kind of just go like they don't know what's going on. You know, they are aware of their worlds. They're like Amara is aware of her block. And not even the whole block, because like there's a part where she learned something from just watching the news once. She's like, oh, what? And that's it. Like, she doesn't keep watching the news. There's no point. Like, I did not have that in mind for her. She caught the news once. She was like, feels bad. Won't be doing this again. You know, does any of that make sense?
No. It's all good. Dread has long been used by British creators as a mirror to hold, you know, as a way of holding up America to British society, but using kind of American cultural ideas and signifiers and the violence and what is viewed as American, the big extreme American way of living. As an American writer, what's your take on that? What's your feeling on that? Is that something that you feel you plug into? Is it useful to think of Joyce Dredd in those terms? Or, as you said, you know, is it more because of the nature of the setting of this novel that you're playing it with a straight bat? You know, basically, how much has, you know, that kind of cultural transatlantic interchange aided or challenged you?
So, I think that I didn't like, I know of Judge Dredd and that universe as, you know, looking back, like I said, looking back and looking forward at the same time. And I didn't really think of it in terms of, you know, just Britishness, like, but I was aware of it because, I know the history of the strip and I know a lot of the creators who've talked about like their influences and the movie also helped because it was very like, this is both very British and very American. Wow. You know, like, so I had those thoughts in my head. But for me, I was doing the looking back, looking forward while writing from my experiences and my understanding of American history, because I am a giant nerd. I have a undergraduate history degree and I focused on comics, but it was also like gender and race and stuff. And so I was thinking, so this was more like near past for me, for Infamous, like thinking of that, but like also trying to slot it into like, what do we know about how people kind of think about online cultures and the evolution of those relationships? Like, I'm obsessed with the parasocial relationship, that concept of that celebrity is not a celebrity. They're my friend. I would kill for them. You know, like, that the relationships we create with influencers, bloggers, like there are people who have parasocial relationships with me, which is like really wild. And I, of course, have a parasocial relationship with every member of BTS, clearly. and so like, what we do to maintain the parasocial relationship is something I was thinking of, because like, how does that evolve in a high-tech space? Like, it's not like British people don't experience the parasocial relationship. We're seeing very negative kind of versions of that with like the monarchy, right? Like, we're seeing a negative parasocial relationship there. We see it with like footballers, So positive with footballers. So I was thinking of that, but also because of the nature of Judge Dredd and also just how loud and annoying Americans are, I was thinking like, because that's true. They are. We are. I was thinking.
I know, like, some very loud and annoying British people, if that helps.
I have British cousins and they are very loud, but I'm louder. So. So thinking just in terms of Because it felt really weird. It feels really weird to say this, but I did kind of go into Infamous going, this is going to be very American-centric on purpose. Like, the energy is incredibly American. Like, if I could, I would have said it in Florida. That's what I was thinking. So I am aware of the role the Judge Dredd universe plays in kind of helping British sci-fi comic writers kind of think about socio-political histories, which is like really cool to say out loud. But I went into it kind of like head empty, fully American.
Is there anything that you wanted to include or didn't, or was there any kind of dead ends where you went, oh, I really want to include this, that's not going to work, so I've got to jettison that?
Also, first of all, the cannibalism again, cannot figure out why I can't get that, but hopefully one day I will write some kind of cannibalism into the Judge Dredd universe.
Is this a personal interest or
yes. Yes. I diehard Hannibal fan, read the books, watched all the movies, watched the TV show, fight with the fandom regularly. Love theorizing futures of cannibalism, which is really messed up. But I think it's fascinating. And so I always want to get it into things because I want to then talk about cannibalism, but it hasn't happened yet. But if anybody needs me to write, like, I don't know, some kind of like messed up horror stuff, I got you. It'll be cannibalism. The other thing I kind of wanted to incorporate, but I just kind of like flopped, I guess it kind of flopped, was I wanted more presence of like Amara's family, like not her parents, because like them being absent is actually really important to why she ends up with the kids she does, but her siblings are also extremely online, you know, like her younger siblings, except for the obvious baby, they're all extremely online. And, you know, I think that siblings tend to be in each other's business if they grow up together, whether positively or negative. So I kind of wish that I had been able to get them engaging with her content or her like trying to like talk to them about what she's doing. But I had so many other characters, you know, just peppered through, and I was like, oh, this is a lot. I keep losing my post-it with everybody's names and descriptions. So let me not. I think at one point in the first like draft 1.5, David was like, yeah, that's not how many siblings she has. Because I like wrote the wrong number, or I wrote like wrong names. I was like, yeah, we can't flesh them out further. That's not gonna happen. And I think and I'm just really hopeful like in the future I'll get to do more, because I really love this, and I never expected to kind of get to do science fiction. Usually like what I've done is like urban fantasy, like, you know, contemporary, either like our world but with werewolves, or like a secondary Earth or a secondary planet, right? So this is like really cool to me to get to write science fiction on any level. It's not like hard sci-fi, because I'm bad at that science stuff, but it's been really cool. But I kind of want, if there's an opportunity ever to like what room there would be in the Judge Dredd universe to take like an urban fantasy angle, you know, like, so that's something like I always have, like the two times I've been commissioned, I have my notebook and I put ideas down, and like, so I'll have like Florida, very prominently Florida, cannibalism, possible urban fantasy, ? And so far those three haven't happened yet, but you know, the future exists as a thing for now.
But that's always been the one of the wonderful things about Dredd is that he fit, well, his world fits so many different genres and ideas. So, you know, you can do horror, you can do straight satire, you can do over the top stuff, whatever you want to do. You know, I mean, there's werewolves in his world.
Yes. I have to like Just if anybody wants to commission me to write more of this, wink, wink, nudge, nudge. I write a mean werewolf. Just saying.
Well, thank you so much to Stitch for that absolutely fascinating chat. And as I said, you can get Infamous in ebook and limited edition print edition from 2000ad.com next week. Now, as I said, we've got Oliver Pickles and David Roach next to talk about the Judge Dredd by Brian Bolland Apex edition. Going to be such a gorgeous book. So it was great to be able to connect with them and just talk through the mechanics of a project like this, getting scans of artwork from all over the world and bringing them together into one oversized, gorgeous print edition, which is out in February. So it's great to welcome back almost regulars now to the Thrillcast. We have Oliver Pickles from The Office, from he's one of our graphic novel editors, and we have David Roach. Now, David, I guess the last time we had you on was to talk about the Masters of British Comic Art.
I think it was, yes.
Yeah, which came out last year and went down very, very well, and was nominated for an Eisner this year. Now, I wanted to get you both on because over the past number of months, the pre-order for the Judge Dredd by Brian Bolland Apex edition has been up. And that's closed now. And it's coming out in February. So I just wanted to take this opportunity to have a little chat about it and kind of whet people's appetite for what may well be coming up. But Oliver, tell me a bit about the beginning of this project, because I mean this has been quite an undertaking, hasn't it?
Yeah, I think the initial idea, or the initial thing, was the Zenith Apex edition several years ago, and then it was with that. I believe all the artwork was with Steve, anyway.
Yeah.
But the idea to do a subsequent book, that there's going to be lots of legwork, because other artists don't keep all their artwork nicely archived and ready for an Apex edition to come along and print it again. So I think for many years it was very much a case of how on earth are we going to go about this? Because pretty much, not just Bolland, but pretty much everyone's artwork is scattered to the wind. And because these are not like American 22-page comics where a collector will probably come along and buy them all, they're just sort of six pages here and there. Often artists aren't even drawing the full story of the big epics. They're just doing either one-offs or little bits. So just a case of just how on earth is this going to happen? And I met Scott Dunbier from IDW in Portsmouth, probably about, well, before the pandemic, so about 3 years ago now. And that was an interesting conversation with him. But David's been the one who has come along, and he knows where the bodies are buried, where the pages are.
Well, David, let's turn to you, because I quite often hear stories of people going into Forbidden Planet at their old location back in the 1980s and seeing pages of Bolland and McMahon and O'Neill on the walls for sale for, I mean, it was probably quite a lot at the time, but a pittance now. And as Oliver says, these are all, many of these pages are scattered to the four winds. Do you want to tell us a little bit about, well, fill us in on the kind of history of how this diaspora of pages occurred, because there's a whole story to do with lack of care and attention, even theft. With in particular the Bolland pages, isn't there?
Yeah, with Brian's work, it is much more controversial than other artists, because a big chunk of it was stolen from IPC's offices, as far as I know. I mean, he's posted from time to time on Facebook about the list of pages that's missing. Of course, IPC's warehouse was quite sort of porous in those days. Anybody could walk in, And in fact, editorial would constantly be going in, rifling through packs of old artwork to repurpose the originals for annuals and specials and that sort of thing. And then for syndication around the world. And you'd have these same strips endlessly sold elsewhere. So there was a constant to and fro of people going into the warehouse where there would be just mountains and mountains of brown paper wrapped pages. Anybody could go in and go out with anything they wanted to. I don't know if they were ever checked, whether they'd have to sign out and then sign in again. I suspect not. So the work disseminated around the world. As you say, a lot was sold in Forbidden Planet. I remember seeing some as a child, and it would have been all of £60 or £70, which was a fortune back then. I bought some pages from Mick back in the early 80s directly from him, and prices ranged from £60 for a Slane all the way down to £15 for a Judge Dredd. Because in Mick's mind, if it was earlier, it wasn't any good, so nobody would want it. So he'd only have to charge £15. We were taking it off his hands. I know, it's incredible, really. With this particular book, I can't remember if it was Oliver or Ben, our publisher, but I was written to in about April or May last year. Could I help find any artwork for Brian's book? So I wrote back and said, well, I can probably give it a good go. The next email I had was, okay, you're doing it, and can you do a McMahon book at the same time? Because I've done so many books over the years, and I demand to have the best reproduction possible, for years and years now, I've been contacting collectors, asking if I could get scans. And this would be Spanish artwork or British artwork for the last book. And very often, collectors don't just have one page, they have hundreds. So it literally has been, for the last 18 months, I have just been writing endlessly to people who I know have got pages or might have pages or might know somebody who does, and just seeing what's out there. And then, if they have pages, I then have to bother them endlessly to get scans made, because not everybody has an A3 scanner. In fact, only artists do, generally. So it's always demanding.
I like the idea of this almost being like a detection story, you know, that kind of tracking down pages, or you haven't got it, so who does? Or they sold it on to them, but, you know, their phone number doesn't work anymore, that kind of thing. Were there particular pages that were very particularly dogged in their their mystery, as it were?
Well, there's a lot that I've never found. For one thing, most of Brian's double page spreads were stolen. So we don't get a double page spread in the book until about the third or fourth year that Brian was drawing Judge Dredd. I can never find any of the Judge Death pages. We have a lot of the Dark Judges, though not the double page spreads there either. But no, the original three-part Judge Death story, I have just never seen hide nor hair of it. Who knows where it is? Very, very few of the stolen pages have surfaced, apart from the Jolly Green Giant stories. And in fact, there's one online, or there was one online at the moment. For some reason, that two pages seems to have made its way to America. So pages have been sold through auction houses there and through eBay over the last sort of 10 or 15 years. Where they've come from, I've no idea. There were certain pages I particularly wanted to have in the book, notably Gaze into the Fist of Dread, which is in the book. But, you know, with Brian, it's all brilliant. So you just can't go wrong. But it was really a case of, can I find them? I think the most amazing discovery for me was literally, as you mentioned, a sort of a detective story where somebody mentioned a friend of theirs. And I think the friend mentioned somebody else. This was somebody I'd never heard of. And in common with a lot of British collectors, they weren't particularly connected to art collecting circles or comic fandom. They were just somebody that loved the comic, might have gone to a convention once or twice, picked up their art, but nobody knew who they were. And this person ended up having a 1983 annual cover, I think it was, which is one of the highlights of the book because it's not as well known as some of the other pieces. And it just looks absolutely gorgeous. But it was just like, who are you? I've never heard of you. How have you got such amazing artwork?
This is, as Oliver said, this isn't our first foray into these kind of oversized books, but it is the first where we've not had everything together and there's had to be a degree of detective work. What do you think is the value of doing a book like this? Like, obviously, you know, people want to see the artwork. It's a certain size that means you're as close to seeing the original artwork in front of you as can be. But what's the value of drawing together sometimes quite disparate pages, but just showing them in this way, do you think?
I know Brian, on the one hand, is slightly conflicted about the presentation of his work this way because he uses very thin ink for one thing, and it's always drawn for reproduction. And he loves the idea that you have these very pure lines, this very pure black. But rather than as a way of reading the stories, I look at it as almost like an art exhibition. We're never going to have an exhibition of 140 Brian Bolland Judge Dredd originals. It's just never going to happen. They are literally scattered around the world. We've got pages from America, Australia, France, Spain, Ireland, all over the place. It's never going to happen to get them all together in one place. But this book is as close as you're going to have to that sort of dream art exhibition. From my point of view, it's just the fanboy thing of how does he do it? You know, looking to see close up each brush stroke or pen stroke, or where is the white out? Where has something been cut out? It's fascinating.
Because the added element here is that Brian has been fully digital in his artwork for quite a long time, so you know this is it. there's not really going to be any more. Certainly not kind of sequential work. Oliver, are there any particular challenges in presenting something like this, both in terms of the reproduction and also just the physical artifact of it?
Well, I mean, we chose the worst possible time to start doing this. As David says, he got the email in April last year. I'm sure everyone can remember what happened in March last year. One of the challenges has been getting scans in from people. People have either had to be willing to send us their artwork, and when they've not been wanting to do that, they've scanned it at a scan shop or various places. The trick then is to make everything look uniformly excellent in its presentation across the board as much as possible, despite the fact that, you know, different places have different scanners, you know, different methods. That's been arguably the main problem we've been facing over the last sort of few weeks of just finishing this book up, just making absolutely sure that everything looks like we scanned it on the same scanner in the office at our leisure when it's not been like that at all. But I believe that's been accomplished now.
I think it's
fantastic, yeah.
It looks amazing. In fact, one of the pictures which we were talking about just yesterday, Oliver and myself, is a framed page, which normally is impossible to use at all. And somebody used their digital camera, or they had a friend with a really, really high-end digital camera, which they've taken the photograph of. And it's just about usable. It's on the edge of not being usable, but it's such a fantastic cover. We just had to use it. But it was it's slightly wonky as well. So we had the amazing art droids were using their magic on it to square it up and make it look decent.
Yeah, Sam Gretton and Joe Morgan have been invaluable on just making sure that the problems with scanning on a technical level have been removed. And so it looks like you are looking at the artwork rather than through something that's gone wrong.
it's one of those things that is endlessly fascinating. And David, you touched on this, that it's that element of how do they do it? You know, were mistakes made? What has this page been through? Because, of course, a lot of these have printer's marks on, which speaks to a different age, where these were literally loaded onto drums not even scanning, they were photographed and turned into transparencies. I guess that's part of the allure as well, is that it's from a bygone age of you know, ink coming off on your hands from cheap bond paper and things like that.
In fact, on the other side of the room here, I've got a John M. Burns Judge Dredd page. And John liked working on board. So what they would have to do is get some sort of a knife and cut the top layer of paper off from the board so it could wrap around the drum that you were talking about.
Oh, that makes me break out in a sweat.
Yeah. And there's little bits of sellotape on the corners of this page, attaching it back to the back of the board. We've got one page in Brian's book from the Jigsaw Man, a double page spread. It's absolutely gorgeous, but it has been through the wars. I can tell you, there are cuts, there's bits that are taped up. The logos are all just sort of haphazardly glued on. The edges are all coming off. It's really not in a good state.
Share the screen for a second. This, don't know if you can see that here, with the logo being cut off and everything.
There we go.
So yeah, but that's what makes this book. Like that's the point of this book, as much as anything.
And lots of glue stains all over them.
Yeah. Mike, you're on mute.
That's going to be fantastic for our listeners. These are available on YouTube for those of you who want to have that brief view of that.
I have to buy the book to find out.
Absolutely. Because particularly with something like Bolland, because like I said, he's gone all digital, but also his style is so accurate, you know, so clear, so particular. I guess part of the joy of a book like this is that you can see those details up close that you wouldn't necessarily be able to zero in on with a reproduction of them. And I mean, this thing is going to be huge, isn't it, Oliver?
Yeah, I've got it just out of reach over there. But yes, yeah, I've got a blank version of the book that if I held it up, it would cover this entire screen. But yeah, it's going to be massive.
Because you mentioned you met Scott Dumbier from IDW, and they've been doing artist editions like this for many years. In fact, I think I've got an EC Comics one that they did underneath my desk at work. Did he have any advice, any tips for embarking on a project like this, or did he say just don't?
Well, I mean, he did say good luck. But no, I mean, we talked so sort of generally about the project as a whole. We weren't getting into the fine details of it, but he did sort of say like it's a lot of work. Like it's his job at IDW to do. I don't know how many he does a year, but that's his job, and like that's all he does. Goes around, with his massive scanner. You know, I think he was mentioning talking about Jim Steranko. Jim Steranko would bring out one piece of artwork from his archive at a time and let Scott scan it, take it back into the archive, get another piece of art. You know, that kind of thing, which we weren't able to do with the various people who own the Brian Bolland pages because of just how things are. But it's just such a labor-intensive thing to, I mean, on paper it sounds easy. Just scan the artwork and print it in a book. Easy. but it's just getting it right and making sure the scans are right. Yeah.
Each time I have to describe to people exactly what I want. And it's often not what they're used to doing at all. So there'll be people saying, well, I don't know how to save as a TIFF file. I can only give you a JPEG. And I'll have to explain, this book is going to be about 2 feet tall. We can't use JPEGs. It's really got to be these enormous files. And there were a couple of people in the end who just got completely cheesed off with me bothering them so much that they gave up and didn't send us the artwork. And I can totally understand it because I am just endlessly bothering people and they must just wince when they see an email from me. But the selling point is always it's for the greater good. You'll appreciate it when it's in print. But no, we've missed out on a lot of art because people couldn't find the time or the artwork has been framed. There's a collector in America who's got 3 or 4 amazing pieces, covers from 2000 AD, but they're framed on his wall. And to get them unframed and then reframed would be hundreds and hundreds of pounds, and he didn't want to do it. And you can understand that. It's a lot to ask. So the fact that we have about, I think we do actually have 140 originals plus about 12 or 18. I think we might actually have 18 prelim sketches as well. In the latest version, I think we've got 18 prelims. So
just bumped up to 24, but yeah.
24 it's only, prelims. Yeah. There you go. Even more exciting. Genuinely, it's a miracle that we've got that many because at one point, it was looking like we were going to be really stretched to get a 96-page book.
Absolutely. Like initially, there was one idea to fill out the book, in inverted commas, with like the idea was if we don't have all the Dark Judges pages, it's okay. We'll just put facsimiles of the missing pages in so it adds up to a complete story. Then we found ourselves with 96 pages, and then we found ourselves with 128 pages. And we solicited the book as a 128-page book. And within the last two, three months, David just kept sending me extra pages, which was quite annoying, considering the book had been set in stone as 128 pages. And so at last second, we did bump it up to 144 pages. But that is the... And you know what? I think once this book comes out, there'll be another wave of people saying, oh, actually, oh, I've got a page.
I wouldn't be at all surprised. A lot of the research that I've done is going to Comic Art Fans, which is a fantastic American website. It's not the best place to find 2000 AD artwork, but Brian is enough of a star in America that Americans have been buying his work, whether they know who Judge Dredd is or not. And there's certainly one person on there that I contacted that I think had one or two pages up. And he very kindly agreed to do some scans for me. And then he'd say, oh, well, I've got this one as well. Would you like that? Would you like this one? I've got these pages from Judge Cal. Is that of any interest? Would you like another Judge Child double page spread? It was unbelievable. And he kept on finding them. We've got two Judge Child spreads in the book. And One of them, he said to me, I can't find it. It must be somewhere. And then there was this week-long wait as he searched his house. And he finally got back to me and said, oh, it was behind the sofa all along. You think, how can you not know? If you had a Judge Child double page spread by Brian Bolland, you'd think you'd know where it was, wouldn't you?
I mean, yeah, there's nothing weird as folk. One thing I want to ask about, because we've already mentioned his slight reticence, is about Brian's involvement in this book. Because, I mean, right back at the beginning, we contacted him and said, we want to do this book. Did he have anything in his archive that was of use, or was it all scattered to the four winds?
He had a few pages here.
Yeah, he did. He did. I was surprised by this. I've contacted people in batches so that I've not got 100 people to chase up all the time. And I was always going to ask Brian at the end, because I just thought, well, he's only got one or two things. I visited him 2 years ago and spent a whole day in his studio looking through his originals. And all I could remember was one Dark Judges original. So I thought, well, he's only got that. So I know there's that, it's like that page is in the bag. But then when I came to ask him, well, in fact, he sent me a message and said, David, why haven't you asked me what I've got? So I said, okay, well, fine. What have you got? And it turned out that he had a few more dreads than I knew, including a page of Orlok, which is fantastic. He had the first cover he ever drew, which was Prog 11. It's absolutely gorgeous. And then he had all these Walter the Wobot pages, which is such a lovely treat, because as an old fan of the comic, you know, I loved the strip, and it's a really quirky sort of thing. He had almost all the pages. One or two had been sold over the years, but it's lovely to have things that nobody has ever seen the originals of. You know, they're not on Comic Art Fans. You won't have seen them for sale in shops. So that was a really lovely surprise that he had so many. And he's also sent us some really nice prelims of his Eagle Dread covers with ideas that weren't picked up. I think for one of them, which is a Judge Anderson issue, I think it's number 26, possibly.
Yeah, 26, 7, 8.
Yeah, he did multiple versions of the cover, some of which completely different to the one that was used, but they're all fantastic. Even Brian's rejected images are just really lovely to see. And of course, they're all beautifully drawn. Even the sketches are lovely.
Of course, people who ordered the exclusive slipcase edition have a brand new print and
have
a slipcase to go with it. And those editions are signed as well. I mean, it's nice to be able to put something out of this, particularly considering it's going to be the 45th anniversary when this comes out, but to really paying tribute sounds like he's dead, and of course he isn't. but you know, just do something nice, you know, something meaty, something that really does show his artwork off in a way that we've never done before. You know, in this anniversary year, it just seems like the perfect time to do it. You know,
and particularly in the early days, the prog was printed so badly that a lot of his work, a lot of the sort of the beautiful line work did get lost. And that in the book, you can really see his evolution as an artist through the years. We've got so many of his fantastic Eagle covers as well, when he was absolutely at the top of his game. Every one of them is a classic image. And the amount of work he put into them is absolutely astonishing. There's one, I think it's around Prog 20, where there's a giant Sov tank that's about to crush him. And there's so much cross-hatching on it that you can't believe anybody would spend so much time doing all this line work. And of course, when it was printed, it was covered up with color and it was shrunk down so much. It really makes you appreciate his work even more than seeing it in print. It's some of the images, as I was getting them sent through from people, I'd blow them up on my screen and I'd just go, wow, look at this. It's incredible.
I think he's a bit rich for somebody like David Roach to accuse anybody else of using an awful lot of cross-hatching in their work.
guilty as charged.
Well, it's interesting that you mentioned the Eagle covers, because of course it's those Eagle reprints and I'm talking about the interiors here, as shonky as they could be, as, you know, repurposed for American format as they were. Those covers, those comics are what broke Dread in America. Mm-hmm. You know, the awareness of the comics from the 1980s, whether it's Anthrax doing a song about him or you know, even the Judge Dredd film in the 1990s, you know, those covers were so influential that it's fantastic that we've been able to get as many as we have into the book, and they look beautiful.
16 in the end, but yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think some of the covers have become every bit as iconic as his 2000 AD covers. And I think it's great to have them all in one book, because I suspect there's a lot of British collectors that won't have seen them. You know, we see so many of the early prog covers reprinted again and again. And these covers, these Eagle covers, don't seem to have been reprinted anything like as much. And he started drawing them almost the minute he stopped drawing for the weekly comic. So it's just this real continuation of and evolution of his style.
Now, the one thing that, as soon as we mentioned that we were going to be doing an Apex edition for Bolland, people started saying, well, what about this artist? What about this artist? And of course, we have subsequently announced that we are continuing the line next year, late next year, October, with the Judge Dredd by Mick McMahon book. Now, Mick's lesser known in America. But his Dredd work, I don't know. I mean, everyone's got an opinion on this. Is Mick as influential on Dredd as Brian was? More influential, less influential? You know, that kind of, you know, the big boots style, the way that Mick's stuff evolved over the years. And there's so much more of it than Brian did. You know, what's your feeling, David, on his place within the pantheon?
Certainly, if I go by the comments on my Facebook page, which I admit is not scientifically accurate, but I think there have been as many people excited about the McMahon as the Bolland books. There's a lot of people who think that Mick was the greatest Dredd artist and, you know, aren't interested in Brian's work at all. It was one of the things that I was surprised by when I was contacting collectors. There aren't that many that have big collections of both. They tended to either be Bolland or McMahon fans, which is quite unusual. Of course, Mick's work isn't as expensive as Brian's, so, you know, and there's about three times as much of it. So that might have something to do with it. But no, I think there are two traditions in 2000 AD, two artistic traditions. You've got what you might call the Bolland Gibbons style, which someone like myself was much more influenced by, particularly since I was drawing a lot of Brian's characters in Judge Death and Judge Anderson and so on. And then you've got the McMahon, Ezcarra, O'Neill group, where the work is more sort of less realistic, but much more expressive and adventurous and gritty. And I think if you look at the prog over the years, the sort of the gritty experimental McMahon school probably outnumbers the Bolland school, I would guess. I mean, I don't know exactly who the most popular artists working in the comic today are, but I would guess that Henry Flint is probably the most popular. And he's, you know, judging by, you know, as a fan favorite, and he totally comes from the McMahon Ezcarra school. Nobody draws quite like Mick, though some have tried over the years, it must be said. but he's a complete one-off, isn't he? When you look at his work, it is so original. It's touched by greatness. And I think if you ask Brian, well, I know if you ask Brian, he would say that for him, Mick was absolutely the definitive Dread artist.
It's something we touched on the podcast before about how somebody like Esquerra, you see very few people trying to draw like him because his style is so utterly unique. You know, there's some mercurial quality about it. Of course, Mick was brought on as a young man to specifically mimic Carlos's work, but then quickly evolved his own. And to a certain extent, it's the same with Kevin as well. That, you know, when you see an O'Neill original, you know that it's Kev. Like, it can't be anybody else because there's nobody who draws like him. Oliver, looking at the looking ahead to the McMahon book, are there lessons from doing the Bolland book that you're applying to the McMahon one?
Well, there's less worry about scarcity of pages. That's taken care of. But we've got pages aplenty. And so for the McMahon book, I think it's more about curating what we have into the different volumes. You know, everyone wants Sky Chariots, which isn't Judge Dredd. So it doesn't necessarily fit alongside the Judge Dredd by Mick McMahon title we've got. So I guess that would require its own separate book. So it's more a case of finding what fits in this. And because Mick changed his style so much throughout the years, there's a real evolution. With this Bolland book, we've put things in order anyway. But to do that with McMahon would be just a fantastic lesson in someone discovering themselves, moving away from their influences, becoming their own artist, and then just constantly evolving relentlessly in wonderful ways. But in terms of learning lessons from this Bolland book, I mean, once you've done it once, it's a bit easier the second time.
We should talk a little bit about page sizes, shouldn't we, Oliver?
Yeah, that's the thing different. By the time he got round, by the time Brian Bolland got round to the Judge Death Lives, his pages were much smaller than they were when he was drawing Cursed Earth. We've got more Cursed Earth pages from the banned episodes than we do of the non-banned episodes of Cursed Earth. I don't know what that's about, but maybe people are more willing to admit they own those. But the Cursed Earth pages are as big as the book. Maybe even they're supposed to be a little bit bigger. But the dark, I know this is both visual and a podcast, so I'm trying to balance both out. With the Dark Judges, they were more square than the Cursed Earth pages. And again, I guess that's just an artist learning that maybe they don't want to be hunched over a massive drawing board for 12 hours a day. Maybe just an average size drawing board would be good enough.
I very specifically remember Cy Fraser when he came back to doing a Dread after years doing Nicolai Dante. He said, "Oh, yeah, I started off. I decided I was going to do the pages in A2, and then by page two, I was back down to A3 again because I realised how much work it was."
I also don't know if it's a kind of familiarity with the character. If you know what you're drawing, you can be like, "Okay, I don't need the massive landscape. I can get this down in detail in a much smaller scale." But,
David, I think you've got some actual physical examples.
I do, which isn't going to really mean much to the people on the podcast. For instance, I've got a Roadbusters splash page here, which is from Prog 105 in 1979. And I've got a Slain page here from A Hero's Blood, which is 1984. And if I put the two together, you can see that the Slain page is about two thirds of the size of the Robusters page, it might be that after a while the artist realized, well, if the page is smaller, I can do it more quickly. But certainly, if the further back you go in British comics, everybody was drawing at an absolutely enormous size, more or less A2 or even bigger. For my previous book, I scanned, David Lloyd lent me, I should say this slain page was David Lloyd's, which I will give back. David lent me a Wrath of the Gods page by Ron Embleton, and it was like a door. It was biggest piece of art I've ever seen. It took 10 A3 scans to put it together. Clearly by sort of the early 80s, both Brian and Mick thought, let's make life a little bit easier for ourselves. Let's draw smaller than we were. And the artwork will be sort of punchier in print as well, I suppose. I've gone the other direction because my originals get bigger and bigger as I get older, but that might be because my eyesight's going, which is, and see, when Brian works digitally now, of course, he can enlarge the image on the screen as big as he wants to, which is an enormous help for him, which is one of the reasons why he went over to digital work in the first place.
Is there, looking at the Bolland book, is there a favourite page? And is it a favourite because, you remember it and it's a great piece of art? Or have you discovered a new favourite by actually looking at the huge scans?
I thought you were going to say, is there a favourite page and is it the Fist of Dread page?
I was going to say earlier that actually it's a good job we've got that one in, because otherwise I'm not sure the project would have been worth it. But there you go. That's just me. Have you discovered like a new favourite, or is it just solidified the favourite that you have, David?
Oh, I'm going first, am I? We have four pages from the Orlok story, which was Brian's last episode. And I've always felt that that was the single best Dread he ever drew. The line work is so exquisite. It's so perfect. It would be lovely to have the whole episode, but to have four pages is quite something. The other thing that I love it all, of course, but I'm so thrilled that Brian actually had his cover from Prog 11, which is a Dan Dare cover, actually. And it's Brian drawing Ballard and Ellie's characters. So that's sort of quite weird in itself. But what a treat to have something so early, so rare, because early 2000 AD covers just do not come up very often. I don't know where so many of them are, but there's loads that I've never seen. That was a real treat. And I can remember as a 12-year-old buying that comic in my local newsagent and just really loving it. So that was such a treat.
Oliver, what about you?
It'd have to be the Judge Child Quest splash pages, the double page spreads that we've got in there, especially the Jigsaw Man. We've got both of those episodes that he did, the splash pages. And I just think that's, for me, that's peak Brian Bolland.
Yeah, it's really, really quirky stuff, isn't it? So inventive. There's loads going on in the backgrounds of those pages. Yeah, they're some of the best art, and they're definitely the worst condition pages in the book. Yeah. No doubt about it.
But still readable. I just want to point
out to anybody
who shelled out their money for a copy, still very readable.
They are totally readable, but I think readers will look at it and think, well, they need to be restored before they just completely fall apart.
Brilliant, wonderful. Well, I mean, I'm looking forward to seeing a comp. I don't think we're getting comps in the office, but you know. Oh, are we? Yeah. Oh, wonderful. Okay, yeah. I'll make sure I'm in on that day then. I guess thank you for all the work that you've done on this. It's the beginning of a new project for us at Rebellion, and very much looking forward to the Mick book, and of course the Ron Smith book, which you know, I absolutely demand and insist occurs.
There's a list of people we want, yeah.
Yeah, Oliver and I have written back and forth between each other for quite a while now, saying, well, how about so-and-so? How about this person? I mean, I from my point of view, I think Dave Gibbons and Kevin O'Neill are really crying out for their books. But then Oliver said to me, what about Cam Kennedy? And I thought, yeah, you can imagine a Cam Kennedy collection would look really fantastic.
Yeah.
And I happen to know a collector who didn't have any Bolland. He only had three McMahons, but he has, I don't know, about 100 Dave Gibbons and hundreds of Ron Smiths. So that's your book straight there. There's a Ron Smith collection. If, you know, my brother actually had bought a few Ron Smith originals not so long ago with, I think it was a story called The Black Sea. And there was a character who had sort of dreadlocks. He was like a pirate. But
Black Atlantic.
Black Atlantic.
Yeah.
Yeah. And he had these sort of mechanical dreadlocks. And honestly, the line work on those is absolutely incredible. I think if I could point to any 2000 AD artist who I thought was criminally underrated, it would be Ron Smith. His originals are absolutely gorgeous. I think we just took him for granted.
Yeah, far too much. I've mentioned this before, but the Hot Dog Run was my first exposure to Dredd and to Ron Smith at the same time. It's still one of my all-time favorite Dredd stories. But there was we're talking 20 years ago. There was a traveling exhibition of 2000 AD artwork that happened to come up to the town where I was a cub reporter, and so I chose every opportunity I could to do a story about it. But it had one of the pages from Pirates of the Black Atlantic. Pirates of the Black Atlantic. I'm sure people correct me if I'm wrong, but it's Captain Skank.
Captain Skank. That's the one.
And just flawless. Like you can't see. There's no pencils. You know, he's very skillfully rubbed them out. And the line work is just perfect. Considering this was a man who, you know, had an egg timer on his drawing board telling him how long he had to work on a page. It's just, you're absolutely right. I mean, you know, he was criminally underrated, and I can go on about this forever, but we've run out of time. But yes, thank you so much for your work on this, and very much looking forward to seeing Judge Dredd by Brian Bolland, the Apex edition, out in February next year. Well, thank you so much to David and to Oliver for chatting away there. I can't begin to explain how excited I am about the Bolland Apex edition, but especially the McMahon edition, and whether my colleagues like it or not, a Ron Smith Apex edition. I demand it. Looking forward to that. The pre-order for the McMahon edition should be going up after we've done the 45th anniversary stuff yet to be revealed in February. So we're probably looking at March, April time for the McMahon pre-order. For those of you who've been following on YouTube, you may notice that I am sat in a Judge Dredd Christmas sweater. They arrive pretty swiftly. It's very comfortable, and you can order them in the UK, Ireland, Europe, and North America. So, make sure you don't get on Dredd's naughty list. Order a 2000 AD Christmas jumper now. We should be back in 2 weeks' time, I promise. For more from the Galaxy's Greatest podcast. And until then, take care of yourselves, take care of one another, and as Tharg wills it, Splendig Verthrick.
Alert! 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 Full power levels dangerously high. Alert! Alert! Be 2000 AD every week. Ask your comic book store or newsagent now. Subscribe to the Galaxy's Greatest Comic at 2000adonline.com.